Give yourself some love with our self-care programs at hrnradio.com.
Hello and welcome to Healthy Life Station and this wonderful opportunity to explore our own health and happiness. Each week on the show, we share information from the cutting edge of science, the cutting edge of clinical practice, and we apply the lessons of these breakthroughs to practical insights you can use in your own life, your own health, your own happiness. If you listen to previous shows, you'll hear some of the remarkable minds of our time sharing breakthrough methods that you can apply in your own life to shift your baseline, shift your neurological baseline, shift your hormonal baseline, shift the way your brain functions and your genes express. You'll find all kinds of useful information if you check out our archives, download those shows, and fill your world with these insights. So please do go ahead and check us out, listen to those shows, put them on your wireless mobile device, have something there. So whenever you're feeling off balance, whenever you're feeling a little bit blue, whenever you're feeling less than on top of your game, you can just plug something in to shift yourself right away. Don't let yourself suffer. Don't let yourself feel bogged down or depressed or anxious for a long time. Correct as soon as you can. You deserve a happy life, a balanced life, a life full of enjoyment, a life full of love. And having a plan to correct whenever you feel yourself off balance is part of taking proactive charge of your own inner state and then using all the wonderful wisdom in this program and out there to help yourself shift into a happier state. So every week, tune into the show and listen, explore, and inspire yourself with wonderful people we have sharing with you here. My guest today is Dr. Dan Siegel, and his latest book is called Mind, A Journey to the Heart of Being Human. Now, usually when I interview people on the show, the publisher sends me a book in advance. I look through it, and I prepare questions, and I really delve into the author's work. But I've got to say, this book absolutely gripped me. In fact, I had to confess to Dr. Siegel before the show that I'm only halfway through it because there was so much richness there. I'd actually like to schedule a second show to talk about the second half of the book because there's so much wisdom and so many stories that really illustrate the points he's making there. Dan Siegel is a New York Times bestselling author. He's also the founding editor of the Norton series on interpersonal neurobiology. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA, and also executive director of the MindSight Institute. And again, the new book is called Mind, A Journey to the Heart of Being Human, and you can see more about it at his website, Dr. Dan Siegel, that's Dr. Dan Siegel, siegel.com/books/mind. So, Dan, I am thrilled, delighted, and privileged to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you, Dawson. Thanks for having me on board.
So you're tackling some of the really big topics in this book, and what I love about it is that you aren't approaching it from the kind of ivory tower discussion that many contemplations of consciousness do, but you're really diving into these big issues like what is the mind, what is the relationship between the brain and the mind, and doing it in a way that makes intuitive sense to people as well as tackling the real academic questions there. And I just want to applaud you for taking on this big topic because it is a huge one and one that is actually really an enormous focus of current research and current academic inquiry.
Well, thanks. I think it's a really both interesting topic and in many ways a connecting topic for all of us to address this question of what is this mind that we have and the mind that we use to share when we connect with each other, what is it really all about? So, you know, I thought to do such a book, it had to be really more like a journey that the reader takes along with the writer. So it's not like, as you're saying, it's their final academic answers or anything like that. It's more like, let's look at this together and see who we are, why we're here, what the mind is all about, how the mind works, this kind of thing. So we kind of go through this almost like as a traveling expedition to say, let's look at these questions and see what we get from both science and our own subjective reflections. Yours is the reader, mine is the writer, and let's see if we can address some of these questions in a deep way that's useful to our lives.
One real surprise to me in the book was how much connection tells us about the mind. And I hadn't really thought of it that way, but what you show in the book is that the act of connecting, and of course your own field of interpersonal neurobiology, tells us so much about who we are and how we function. Maybe just cover briefly how big a role that plays in your considerations of mind.
Yeah, well, Dalton, it's a great point you're noting, and you know, the standard thing we're often taught in the basic sciences, like biology or even certain branches of psychology, and certainly in medicine when I went to medical school, was, you know, the mind, your feelings, thoughts, and memories, things like that, those are descriptions of the mind, those are simply activities of the brain. And when you look at it that way, of course, you know, you can get really excited, as we should be, with the new findings of brain science. But you discover soon that actually Hippocrates said this 2,500 years ago. So for thousands of years in science and in medicine, we've been saying, hey, our mental lives are simply brain activity. But what happened with me was noticing that there was something about connection, both within my own subjective world, which was not just brain firing, but subjective experience is another layer, if you will, of mental life than simply just calling it brain activity. And then the connections we have with other people. So one example I give in the book, you know, is of being trained as a college student to work on a suicide prevention service. And, you know, we were taught that the way you connect with a person in a suicidal crisis could make the difference in that person's mind, how they felt, what they thought, how they executed behavior, you know, could make the difference between whether they chose to live or chose to die. And so I guess for me as an adolescent, it was imprinted on me in this deep way that connection, interpersonal connection, shapes the mind. And later when I would learn about neuroscience in college and then further in college and in medical school, it was also the connections in the brain themselves, the neurons, how they connect with each other, was shaped by the connections that were made in relational experiences. So this was a way of thinking where connection can be used both in the inner world of the brain as well as the inner subjective experiences we have and in the interpersonal world. So I just became basically obsessed with the idea of what are those connections truly about and what could connect, what was shared in common between the internal connections and the interpersonal ones.
Also, if you look at studies, for example, of identical twins, and one of whom has PTSD and one of whom doesn't, you can see that in time, their ability to function socially and other things being impacted actually shapes the brain. I just finished looking up a whole bunch of brain volume studies and showing, for example, that in identical twin pairs, one of whom went in and fought in Vietnam and the other twin didn't, that the volume in the hippocampi of the twins who were in Vietnam and had PTSD were measurably smaller than those that didn't. Also, areas of the brain to do with proprioception, one's place in space, one's place in body movement, those spaces shrank relative to the twins without PTSD. And so these kinds of shattering experiences literally change the brain. Not only do they change the way we relate to other people and the rest of the world, but they also are literally over time changing the volume of important regions of our brain.
Right, and one way of understanding those changes, not just in adults, but when they've happened early in life, developmental trauma of abuse and neglect, is a fundamental process which for some reason people generally don't talk about it, and they certainly haven't talked about it much in the past, but it's how the brain, and it turns out any complex system, differentiates aspects of itself, like the higher parts and the lower parts, or this side or that side, how they can be allowed to be differentiated, to be specialized, to be unique, to develop on their own, and yet then to become linked, kind of like cities differentiating in a state, but then having highways that allow goods to be shared across the cities, or, you know, communication channels to be set up with laying down fiber optics. So those are linking connections, and they link differentiated cities, or in the brain, you have different clusters of neurons that communicate very rapidly with each other in certain regions. But then these regions, just like the cities, have linking aspects to them. And you call that integration, the linking of differentiated parts. We now have a ton of scientific evidence to show that trauma, like you're pointing out, even developmental trauma, abuse and neglect, and this is the work of Martin Teicher at Harvard, what Marty has shown is that integration is the fundamental neural process that's impaired in the brain of people who've experienced developmental trauma. And what's amazing is that you can show that positive growth of integration occurs with, let's say, mindfulness training. And a third area of research shows that if you looked at every measure of well-being you could look for, which is, this is the Human Connectome Project that published this in October of 2015, you know, you can show that the best predictor of health is how integrated your brain is, how interconnected the connectome is, which means how the differentiated areas of the brain are linked to each other is the best predictor of every measure of well-being they could find.
That really struck me as I read the book as well, the way you bring up integration over and over and over again. And the other counterpoint you make to that in the book is that when a complex system isn't self-organizing, when that integration isn't there, it tends to move to one of two poles, which are either chaos or rigidity. And that was such a powerful insight to me as I read the case examples you gave there in the book, that people who aren't able to find that sense of integration, that sense of oneness, that sense of self-organization, then will cope either by being rigid or going into chaos. I was so struck how when you apply that model to different kinds of cases, of different kinds of mental health issue, that you could see that pattern over and over and over again.
Yes, it's striking. I'm speaking to you from the room where I first was reading that back in 1992. So it's kind of funny to be here talking to you from this room. And it's striking because I had noticed in my patients that were coming to me, even though I was trained as a board certified this and that, you know, to think in terms of the diagnostic categories we had, it seemed to me that everybody was coming with either chaos or rigidity, like being flooded with something or being shut down. And I thought I was kind of a little nutty in a way because I thought I must be just looking for some kind of overly simplistic model. But when I looked at the DSM, the book of these diagnoses, you know, every symptom of every syndrome can be reinterpreted as chaos or rigidity. And now we have findings not just in trauma, but in people who have not been traumatized, but who do have challenges to mental health, like in cases of schizophrenia or in individuals with autism or people with bipolar disorder. Every study of the brain of individuals with those challenges has impaired integration in the brain. It's not caused by experience. It may be just constitutional or from infection or ways we don't know how it comes. But here we have evidence so far that every study of a psychiatric disorder shows, no matter what the cause, that individuals have impaired integration in the brain. And when you combine that with the incredible finding that every symptom, whatever the cause, of any syndrome in the DSM can be reinterpreted as chaos or rigidity, suddenly this whole model has this framework that all works well together, and then things to do to create well-being, whatever the cause of its challenge to well-being, is to create more integration. And so far, that seems to be working.
Can you tell us some stories about clients, patients you've had, where either one of those extremes became really apparent to you as you worked with them?
Sure. You know, there's a book called Mindsight where, you know, people really wanted to hear case examples of, you know, to make this stuff sort of come alive. So there's a book called Mindsight, which is all case examples. And in that book, I talk about a 92-year-old named Stuart. And Stuart was brought in by his son, who was a therapist, who heard me in a conference and thought his dad had depression and brought him in. And so I was going to evaluate his dad. So his dad comes in, and sure enough, he's shut down, very rigid, you know, in everything. And he's just staying at home. He's not seeing his children or his grandchildren or even his great-grandchildren. He's just isolating himself in rigid disconnection from other people, including in his wife in certain ways. And he'd been married for 65 years at that time. So the history was long, and I have it in the book, so I'll just give you the highlights of it. You know, my sense was, yes, he had rigidity with his presenting complaint, and that's how I do an evaluation. I look for chaos and rigidity and see where it is manifesting in the person's life. His rigidity was basically in the area of relationships and in his awareness of his own internal state, and we call that vertical integration, and his ability to have a wide array of things that he could hold within consciousness. So that would be impairments of consciousness integration. Anyway, there are 9 domains of integration you can review. In his case, he had a few of them that were clearly challenging for him. So I said to him, I said, look, you know, I don't, after we did a certain assessment of his history called the adult attachment interview, I said, I don't think you're depressed like your son says. He goes, oh, I know, I wasn't depressed. He says, but what do you think is going on? I said, well, I think you've had a developmental experience that has made you not really so integrated, and so your wife had been hospitalized, and there was something about that that made you become even more rigid in the way you've lived. And he said, well, I don't think any of this stuff makes any sense. He was an attorney who didn't believe in psychotherapy. And he said, but there's one thing that's very strange. And I go, what's strange? He goes, you know, my law partner, who I started this law firm with years ago, decades ago, he's dying, and I don't feel anything. And he goes, I just think that that's not right. I should have some kind of feeling. I said, well, how do you feel? He goes, you know, my whole life, people ask me questions like, how do you feel? How do you feel this? How do you feel that? He goes, I have never understood what that question was referring to. Hmm. So I knew there was a shutdown in him that had been there a long time, that it wasn't depression. And we embarked on an integrative journey to find out what was blocked in his integration from his relational life that then embedded in his brain. And then once we could figure that out, we then could focus attention, and here's the key, where attention goes, that drives energy flow through the brain in certain ways, neural firing flows and neural connection grows. So the approach was then to say, where is your brain not differentiated enough? And we could identify which area that probably was, and then say, what do I need to do as your therapist to get those areas of the brain firing on purpose with attention so that we can get them to grow? And after 6 months, his wife called me, and she said, I don't know what you did to Stuart, but you must have given him a brain transplant because he's like this person. You know, and so I said, well, it's not really brain surgery, but it is neuroplasticity. And, you know, the secret of the sauce is just figure out where is the integration blocked. And Stuart was 92 when we were doing this work. And I always say about Stuart's case, the reason I love that he let me use this, his case, is because if someone in their 90s can do this, I said, you can too if you're only 88, you know, or whatever, 18, 28, whatever age you are. So the exciting thing is we now know from the studies of neuroplasticity that you can grow the brain in certain very significant ways, especially that promote integration all the way across the lifespan. So it's a thrilling moment.
And the speed of that growth is astonishing sometimes. I was looking at a case history recently of a journalist who was a real skeptic about all this, skeptic about mindfulness, skeptical about neuroplasticity. And so the researchers put him on a 6-week project where he learned mindfulness and meditated briefly every day. Had done much more drinking in his life than meditating. So he was not exactly your ideal candidate, but he did this, and we're going to get a break right now. I'll tell you the rest of the story afterwards, because what happened in his brain over the course of 6 weeks was truly extraordinary. So we'll share that in a moment. You're listening to High Energy Health. See more about the show at highenergyhealth.net for more about Dan's remarkable new book called Mind. Go to his website, Dr. Dan Siegel, drdansiegel.com/books/mind. My name is Dawson Church. We'll be right back after a break.
Radio your way. HealthyLife.net.
Hi, and welcome back to High Energy Health. I'm your host, Dawson Church, and you can see more about our show at highenergyhealth.net. You can also download previous episodes, and I really urge you to have those handy on your wireless mobile device. So the moment you're feeling upset, the moment something throws you off your game, you have an audio program where you could plug in and re-inspire yourself. I know I'm going on vacation soon, and I just spent a little bit of time today downloading 5 really inspiring programs. So the moment I need to shift my focus, shift my mind, become mindful, be aware, anytime anything happens that might be a little bit upsetting or disruptive, I plug in something positive, and I'm proactively making sure I have the resources there to help myself feel better. So go ahead and go to the show's website. That's highenergyhealth.net. Download those inspiring shows and be ready to love yourself to the extent that you'll shift your mind whenever anything bad happens. And again, to find out more about Dan's work, go to drdansiegel.com, and his latest book is /books/mind. Dan, before the break, I was describing this case history of this Australian journalist who was a total skeptic about mindfulness and meditation, and so he reluctantly went on a 6-week odyssey where he'd meditate every day, and also he would practice mindfulness. And the researchers measured his brain volume very carefully beforehand and after the 6 weeks, and various parts of the brain changed in their volume, the amount of volume that was apparent. So he got an MRI before, MRI afterwards, and they compared the volume of the various regions of his brain. But here's the number that absolutely rocked me on my heels. In the parts of his emotional midbrain, the parts of his hippocampus responsible for emotional regulation, those grew by 22%
wow.
in 6 weeks. When I heard that number, I just couldn't. My left brain was just spinning. It was like, I mean, the neuroplasticity is working that fast. The parts of his brain that handled emotional regulation grew by 22% in 6 weeks after he became mindful and began to meditate rather than drink, swear, and do all the other things that he used to be so really good at doing. So, when you mentioned that your 92-year-old patient and how he was able to shift and that his wife asked if he had a brain transplant, the answer is yes, in time, mind actually does build brain. That's remarkable.
Yes, it's remarkable. And now, it basically, as your story of this journalist shows, and other research shows as well, the brain is remarkably responsive to what the mind does with the focus of attention.
Yeah, and then you sustain that over time, and then that focus of attention sustained over a period of days, weeks, and months, then literally is rebuilding those pathways in the brain.
Yeah, well, let's just so people feel like they don't have to do like a month straight of meditating constantly. The idea is exactly what you're saying, Dawson. The regular practice, let's say, for half an hour a day, you're going to create a state of mind that itself is quite integrated. And what that means, I believe, in terms of mindfulness practice, is the mind is differentiating the sensory flow of your breath, let's say, or your feeling in your body, or even the sensation of your thoughts, from the awareness of those sensations, the awareness of those thoughts, the awareness of the emotions you may be having. And that separation, that differentiation of the knowing, if you will, of awareness, and that which is known, the objects of awareness, is a huge integrative act. And a number of studies at UCLA and other places show that when you do that across these different ways you're focusing attention, it creates a very integrated state of firing if you combine it especially with kindness toward yourself and others. So these mindful states, these kindful states, these ways of being in a positive relationship with your own inner experience, then create a state in the brain that itself is integrated. Then, if you practice that for, let's say, 30 minutes, the rest of your day is going to feel very different, as people who do this regularly can tell you. I can tell you that myself. Then a state that's practiced regularly becomes basically moving from an intentionally created practice to an automatically experienced trait. So you go from a state that was created with intention, mindful state from the practice, to then a trait of your life, and that trait is created because the temporary firing during the 30-minute practice, when it's done, as you're saying, over time, over days and weeks and months, regularly, then reinforces it so that we often say, from actually this process of looking at neural firing, neurons that fire together, wire together. But the important thing really is where attention goes, neural firing flows, and neural connection grows. So when you create attention in a way that integrates the brain in that state, it will become a more integrated set of connections as a trait that will be available to you in your life.
And then, of course, when that's your default setting, then life's little annoyances, and there are always going to be life's little annoyances, then those suddenly are less triggering to you.
Yeah. You know, I was traveling in Europe with my 87-and-a-half-year-old mom, and we were traveling to Berlin together to meet my wife and daughter, and it was a great trip. Anyway, she had one leg of the trip, which was on her own. I said, well, Mom, you know, how is that leg for you? She goes, well, you've taught me to be mindful. I said, oh, that's great. And both my wife, Caroline Welch, and myself have taught her to be mindful. And she goes, you guys have taught me, and what you have taught me has allowed me to go from annoyance to amusement. So she goes, so what used to be annoying is now amusing. So I found the trip very amusing. And I said, Mom, well, can I quote you on that? She said, absolutely. So that's great.
Well, see, now we have a new neural filter through which all the information is passing. So the same information is coming in, same inputs, but now it's going through this neural network, this filter we built consciously, proactively, as you were mentioning earlier, and that filter is then interpreting those events very, very, very differently.
Oh, exactly. I mean, I was going to the movies the other day, and it's a long story, but I was sitting in a certain row, and someone said, can I have this seat? I need it for these reserved sections. I said, fine. She goes, take one of those reserved seats in that front, more front row. So I said, that's fine. So I put my jacket down, went to the restroom, came back. Someone had moved my jacket. I said, you know, my jacket was there. The person in the back row wants me to be there. He goes, you can't be here. You're not in the reserve section. He started to be really angry. And then he said to me, I said, well, you know, the woman told me to sit here. He goes, you better get out of here. You better scram. And he had this really angry look on his face. And I knew that I could get really angry back at him because there was all sorts of reasons for me to have a right to be in that seat. But I just looked at him. I said, you know, in these days, we really need to be kind to each other. And I looked right in his eyes, and he got this kind of terrified look. And he goes, I'm a kind person. I'm a kind person. I said, yes, I know you are. Thank you, and you can have the seat. And then I walked and found another seat. But I realized that it's exactly like you're saying. When you practice this way of being present, then whatever automatic physiological reactions might arise, or psychological reactions, or emotional reactions, you can actually be aware of them, but then with the spaciousness of what I call the hub of this wheel, with the spaciousness of awareness itself, you can actually disconnect from the automaticity. So I could have easily engaged this fellow in an intellectual argument of why I have a right to be in that seat, and chose to go a different path just for the sake of everyone in the theater there. But it left me with this deep sense of peacefulness. It wasn't just like I was capitulating. I actually felt very, very calm inside and happy with the outcome.
Yeah, and does it change the other person? Sometimes, not always. Does it change you and make you less stressed? Always, definitely. We'll be back with more after a break. Please stay tuned. You're listening to High Energy Health Radio, highenergyhealth.net. To learn more about Dan and his work and his book, go to drdanseagle.com. And I would strongly recommend you pick up a new copy of his book, Mind, just out, and really, really a brilliant book. So please stay tuned. We'll be right back after a break.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Hi, and welcome back to High Energy Health. I'm your host, Dawson Church, and you can download episodes of the show at highenergyhealth.net. That's highenergyhealth.net. And I'm talking today with Dr. Dan Siegel. He is the author of the new book, Mind, A Journey to the Heart of Being Human. At the beginning of the interview, I told told everyone that I've only read half the book because the book so gripped me and drew me into it that I realized we couldn't possibly cover the book in an hour. So I thought I'd rather really focus on it piece by piece and cover it in two interviews and cover half of it each time. But it's a compelling book. It gives you the science. It gives you the human interest stories behind these discoveries. And it's full of case histories and stories from Dan's life. Strongly recommend you check out the book Mind and also visit his website, drdansiegel.com. Dan, during the break, we were talking about a story you tell in the book about a man who came in for treatment and evaluation when you were a resident, and you'd been working in a suicide prevention hotline, and you realized this guy, I think he actually told you he'd be trying to commit suicide that day. Mm-hmm. And just share that story with us as an example of both the importance of human connection and also how modern medicine often really isn't well-equipped to tune into cases like that.
Absolutely. Well, you know, this was a moment in my second year of medical school. So before my residency, I was still in medical school, and I had had the experience in college of working on a suicide prevention service. So I was, you know, trained basically to tune into other people's internal emotional states in order to try to keep them with hope going so that they would not choose to kill themselves. And, you know, that was my past experience. And then my first year of medical school, you know, there were a number of experiences that suggested that people who were my teachers in the hospital were primarily interested in basically the world of the body and not the world of the person as an individual with a mind, that is, with feelings, with meanings, with things that were part of their memory system, what mattered to them. So there were a number of experiences that happened, but this was my final exam for the introduction to clinical medicine course in my second year. So it was a big moment. And, you know, I went in to do my final exam, which meant a patient would come in, my other students in my group, small group, two or three of us, and, you know, the attending physician, the professor, was there. And when the fellow came in, I said, "Hello, Mr. Smith, you know, how are you today?" And he said, "Well, doc, you know, I'm doing okay, but I tried to kill myself earlier today." And, you know, so all of my suicide prevention service skills got activated, and I, you know, did an assessment of his suicidality, tried to tune into where he was in his life, tried to get connected to, you know, what had led to this attempt, what the seriousness of the attempt was, where he was at now in terms of the future, thinking about how it'd keep him safe, all these things. And then my attending kind of leaned over into my ear and said, "Just do the physical exam." Like this, you know, like, whoa, okay, you know, I'll do the physical exam. So I went into the next room, he got into his robe and came back into the room, you know, when he was ready, and I went there and started doing the physical exam, you know, which we're taught how to do. It's pretty straightforward. But then he had, I'd never seen one before, but a grand mal seizure on the table, and I was, you know, terrified because I'd never seen anyone have a seizure, and here my professor comes and keeps the patient from falling onto the floor. The seizure subsides, and then he just goes over to me and goes, "Just finish the exam. Don't even telling me what's going on." So I complete the exam, and then I, you know, asked if we could take the patient at least to the psychiatric ward, which we did, you know, the outpatient evaluation service, and we did, and then we came back to the room, and he looks at me with his kind of cold eyes, and he says, "You know, well, you know, you asked way too many questions about how this person was feeling, you know, and what was going on in his life." And he had said to me earlier when the seizure happened, you know, he said, "This is just what these drunks do. They just have seizures and try to kill themselves." You know, he goes, "So you asked way too many questions," he says at the end there, "you know, but you did an excellent job with your physical exam, so I'm passing you in the course." You know, and it was like, oh, my God.
Wow.
I realized, I mean, after that, you can imagine that night, I basically decided to drop out of medical school. And, you know, the last thing I wanted to become was someone like him. And during my time away, I realized that, you know, there is this way of perceiving reality that's the physical side of reality. And I was trained as a biochemistry student. I knew how to analyze chemicals and molecules and all that stuff, which is kind of what I was learning in medical school, too. You know, but then there's a whole level of the mind, of our feelings, of our narratives, of what matters to us, of the meaning of things. And, you know, this is all put under the term subjective experience. And amazingly, where I went to medical school, it was not a part of what we were trained to do. And if you brought up things of the mind, like feelings or thoughts or things like that, you were told it wasn't, literally, it wasn't what doctors did. So we learned years later that that was really an error, but it's still the way a lot of medical schools are practiced. And I got to say, when I went back to where I went to medical school, because I did go back with this word mindsight, years later, I would go back, they'd invite me to go back to give a lecture to the Academy of Medical Education, and the deans I had, who had been there when I was in medical school, were sitting in the back row. And one of my friends was in the back row, so I couldn't see way back there. But when they asked me to talk about the mindful brain, which I had just written, but I decided to tell them about why I had dropped out of school and what it was like then and what it was like to come back. And my friend told me that the two deans who were sitting next to, just by coincidence, you know, were crying. And I realized, you know, all of these physicians, they're people with feelings too. They're just not given the skills to have these mindsight abilities, the ability to see the mind in themselves or others. And it's terrifying. You care about your patients. That's the way to take care of them, is to care about them. And you aren't taught how to deal with your feelings of despair when someone you care about is dying. So they just shut down. But then basically they teach us, as one of my teachers told me, there's no time for tears. You know, that there's no time to let the mind be real. So what becomes real is only the things you can measure, you know, with numbers or see in a scan, like a CAT scan of the brain or an EKG of the heart or something. So, you know, on the one hand, those sciences that look at these physical objects are really helpful to people. There's no reason we should exclude the mind. So this is part of another reason why I wrote this book, because, you know, by making the mind under the term subjective experience, people discard it. And then also by making the mind simply brain activity, people just think if you take care of the brain, that somehow you're taking care of the mind, and you're not. So this is why it's, I think, really important we talk about what is this mind and what can we do to have it be as healthy as possible in our connections within our own awareness and our connections with each other.
One of the things that has really shown me the influence of the mind on the brain is doing EEGs with people. And I just got done earlier this year doing 110 EEGs pre- and post-meditation workshop, and we're just getting ready to do a whole bunch more next year. And, Dan, one of the things that you see is you hook someone up to an EEG, you're looking at their brain patterns, you're looking at their brain waves, and then you tell them, think about a problem you've had recently, or even more dramatic, think about a childhood trauma. You mentioned developmental trauma earlier, and I hope we get to that in the next program. But they just a thought. So this is the mind thinking a thought, and this isn't even a reality. It's not as though somebody really there in the room threatening you with a knife or a club. It's just thinking about some bad thing that happened to you in the past, and what you see on the EEG is you see a huge spike, for example, in the brainwaves that are characteristic of fear, and you see a shutdown in the brainwaves that are characteristic of creativity and balance. And so when that happens, people are having a huge surge in stress biochemicals like and they're having big drops. We're also seeing in healthy immune factors like immunoglobulin A. So just a thought, just the activity of the mind is producing these massive and instantaneous changes in the brain. And we'll talk more about this when we come back from a break. You're listening to High Energy Health. I'm your host, Dawson Church. You can find out more about the show at our website, highenergyhealth.net. And for more on Dan's wonderful new book, Mind, A Journey into the Heart of Being Human, check out his website, drdansiegel.com. We'll be right back after a break.
Positive enlightenment. All you need in one place, here at hrnradio.com.
Hello and welcome back to High Energy Health. I'm your host, Dawson Church. You can see more about the show at highenergyhealth.net. I especially encourage you to download past shows and have them readily available to you. So the moment you need some help, some encouragement, some good cheer, you can just press that play button and listen to one of our wonderful guests and have them right there in your ear to help you feel better. Today, I'm talking with Dr. Dan Siegel. He is the author of the new book, Mind, A Journey to the Heart of Being Human. And you can find out more about him at his website, drdansiegel.com. So, Dan, one of those questions that you address in the book, and this is, again, called sometimes a hard problem, is the whole question of consciousness. And I hesitate to ask this question, but how do you personally define consciousness?
Well, it's really interesting, Dawson. The term consciousness, which I use synonymously with, you know, the idea of awareness or being aware, is often not defined even by people who study it. They said they're exploring it because they don't know what it is. For me as a therapist, the way I use the word consciousness or awareness with people I work with is to simply say it's a subjective experience of knowing. So just right now, if I say hello, you've got the word hello, but then you have your awareness of hello. So you can divide consciousness then into two aspects, at least. There's the knowing of hello, and there's the known of hello. And when you divide it that way, then you can see, if you take this concept of integration, how you might integrate consciousness. Integration is how you differentiate aspects of a system and then link them. So in this case, you would differentiate the knowing from the known. And in my office, there's a table that kind of looks like a wheel. And with the people I would work with, we would differentiate knowing from known, putting the knowns on the rim and the knowing in the hub. And we would move systematically a spoke of attention around this rim. And amazingly, people would start having this transformation of the chaos and rigidity in their lives. And with integrating consciousness, basically, they would start getting this higher state of resilience and awareness. When I started doing this in workshops, and now in The Mind, the book you're talking about, Mind, I've given the results of a 10,000-person study where systematically I gave this in workshops to 10,000 people, recorded the results, and then reported them in the book. You get this amazing universality to it, wherever I do this in the world, that no matter a person's cultural background, ethnic background, whatever their educational background, their age, nationality, it doesn't matter. The experiences are incredibly similar, so that you then get this amazing possibility of what the nature of consciousness itself may be. And it's almost like a spoiler alert if you haven't read that yet in the book. And I know you only read half, so you're getting to the half where I really spent a lot of time on this. But I'll just give you a hint that when you ask the question, when is the mind and where is the mind, and look at the mind as this emergent property of energy flow, and you then say, well, if consciousness is a property of the mind, and the mind might be an emergent aspect of energy flow, what exactly is energy? Then what you'll see is the reports I've gotten from all these mathematicians and physicists who look at complex systems from a mathematical point of view, look at energy from a quantum mechanics point of view, and you'll see this graph that looks at how energy can be considered this movement from a sea of potential upward through a series of probabilities to an actuality. So, in other words, energy like light or sound or electrical energy or chemical energy, real things that we experience in our bodies and in our lives, they're part of the universe. It's not some wild, mystical thing. It's part of actual, studyable reality. These are manifestations of possibility into actuality. And when you get into the Wheel of Awareness practice, you find that when people bend this spoke of attention around into the hub itself, when they explore the nature of the experience of knowing, and I just did this just the other day with about 150 people in this workshop we did on Mind, when they experience that, people will describe over and over again the following things. They'll say, incredible peace, openness, eternity. I felt connected to everything, love, God. I felt safe. I felt at home. There's this quality of expansiveness and openness that, from a hub of this wheel point of view, is this deep place of safety that they can feel, this peacefulness they feel. From a physics point of view, I think what might be going on, and I discuss this at great length in the book, what might be going on is that these individuals who've done the practice are dropping the energy position to this plane of possibility, the sea of potential, and they're describing the subjective feeling when they can rest with this open state of sea of potential. And when people do the wheel practice, they've learned the skill of bringing their mind into this open space. And if that's true, then what might be an incredible moment in our history is we have an opportunity as people supporting other people's growth is to help people get to this hub of the wheel, to get to this sea of potential and drop themselves out of rigid or chaotic states that are imprisoning them. So it's really a very practical and science-based insight into how we can use an integration of consciousness to bring more well-being into our collective lives.
And, of course, people are used to collapsing that infinite field of possibilities into the same probability over and over and over again. That's what's conditioning. So
exactly.
People are conditioning when you keep on repeating the same experiences over and over and over again because they're highly conditioned responses. And for really millennia, sages, philosophers, priests, religious leaders, spiritual leaders, psychologists have tried to wrestle with that problem of how do you take people who are highly conditioned to collapsing that way that of infinite possibilities into the same probability of suffering. How do you take people and counter condition them? And I love this idea of separating the knower from the known, because when you do that, you step back and you're no longer wrapped up and so mesmerized by the drama that your emotions are totally entwined in it. You can step back into that place of peace of knowing that's above the drama, transcends the drama, find a self perspective that goes far, far beyond that, and a whole new set of possibilities. Dan, I'm so inspired. I love what you're doing. I love the passion you're bringing into it. I love the clarity you're bringing to it. I love the combination of emotional intelligence and hard science you bring to this. I'm so grateful for the work you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Dawson. It's an honor to be here with you. I look forward to more conversations.
We will cover the second half of the book in a subsequent conversation. Thank you again. And to find out more about the book, and again, the book title is Mind, A Journey to the Heart of Being Human. You can get it online or just visit the website drdansiegel.com/books/mind. You've been listening to High Energy Health, and I recommend you tune in every week at the same time for more inspiring and practical information. Thank you so much. Until I talk to you again, be healthy, be happy.